All these things that we're studying from the Old Testament are for our learning. They're part of the scheme of redemption. They're stories that have been put in there, just like the localities, the places, the geography is there for a reason. The Bible is not just a checklist of things that we make sure we got all the squares checked off. But it's a story from beginning to end. It's a unit. And as we study these things, we study them for the purpose of learning God's will for us. The things written aforetime are written for our learning. We see the manner in which people lived everyday lives. They lived and breathed, and they went about a day's activities like we do, and their interaction with one another and with God. And we can see how it worked out for them, when it worked out well, and why. And the same can be true of us today. We live in a different dispensation, under a different law. But one thing, I remember a man many years ago saying, one thing has always been true. One thing has always been required, and that is obedience. That figures into our lesson today, and all these lessons that we've been studying the last little bit, and it gets to be even more so. Need for obedience. Whatever God has said at any given time is to be obeyed. And Saul seemed to have a problem with that. And we can learn from his failures and others, the failures of others, even people that we consider to be good people. And we can see how it worked out for them and try to live our lives in a way that will be pleasing to God and where we can finish our lives on a good note. As the bard said, all's well that ends well. And that's certainly true of life. And as Ezekiel said, it doesn't make any difference how much good you've done throughout your life. If you come to the end and you've given up or you've gone back into the ways of the world, then all the good that you've done will do you no good. Well, we talked about in our last lesson, we talked about the fact that the people finally came to a realization that they had made a mistake. They shouldn't have asked for a king. I guess they really knew they shouldn't, because they knew God's will in the matter, but they did ask for one. They got him. And yet when Samuel showed them the rather awe-inspiring spectacle of a severe thunderstorm in the middle of the dry season, middle of May to the middle of June, a time when their crops would need to be dry so they wouldn't mildew and things of that kind. They came to the realization, we've made a mistake here in asking for a king. Well, then we find Saul is in Michmash. He's up here in this place and we're in Michmash. And the Philistines are farther south there in Geba. That will change. They're not stagnant. They're not stationary. They are ambitious. But at this particular point, Saul is farther north than the Philistines. Jonathan attacked the Philistines. Saul was given the credit for it. Whether that is significant or not, I don't know whether we could prove it one way or the other, but it does kind of give some indication of Saul's attitude, his desire for preeminence and power. The Philistines amassed a large army. We noticed in chapter 13, verse 5, 30,000 or even 3,000, as it may be translated, chariots, 6,000 horsemen. And the people, the soldiers, the warriors, the people that were up there were up there for the purpose of fighting. And there was the sand of the seashore for multitude. And it was such a fearsome sight that the people of Israel hid. It shows their lack of trust in God. The Hall talked a lot about trust this past week. They had a lack of trust in God. They were fearful. They hid in wherever they could find a place to hide, the caves, the thickets, the holes, the rocks. Every man for himself, it seems. And those who didn't hide, those who stayed with Saul, they followed him But they were not courageous. They were not spoiling for a fight. They were trembling. They were scared. Saul offered a sacrifice, but prematurely. He was not to offer the sacrifice. He'd been told by Samuel that you wait 7 days. When I get there, I'll offer the sacrifice. Saul chose an attitude towards sacrifice and obedience that will crop up in our lesson today. He was told to wait. He didn't wait. And he offered the sacrifice himself. It was not his prerogative to do so. And so God was not pleased with it. Samuel certainly was not pleased with it. That was the first mention of the fact that his kingdom would not continue. It was going to be a one-time thing. He was not going to be the beginning of a dynasty. Even though he tried all through the 40 years that he, or the remainder of the 40 years that he was king, tried to establish that dynasty. And even though he didn't seem to have a very good attitude toward his son, who was the heir apparent to the throne, he seemed more concerned about himself, his legacy, his dynasty, and so forth than he was about his son, as we'll see in our lesson today. Nevertheless, he is told here that his kingdom will not continue, and he tried all through the years to thwart the will of God in that particular case. The Philistines began then to gain the upper hand over the people of Israel. Not because God was weak, not because something had gone wrong and nobody knew what it was. They knew what God knew what it was. Samuel knew what it was. They had just failed to place their trust in God. And then, as we mentioned a little while ago, Saul was up there in Michmash, and that's the way I pronounce it. You may pronounce it otherwise, but I've always pronounced it that way, except before that we'll go into how I pronounced it when I first began seeing it, but it was perhaps a little more comical than that one. But anyway, Saul had been in Michmash and the Philistines further south in Geba. Now the things are changing. The Philistines are advancing not just because of the size of the army, mainly because of the failure of Israel to trust in God, but the fact that they had so many people didn't hurt anything. And they had moved into Michmash. And now in the first part of chapter 14, we find them further north than the army of Saul, which was down in Gibeah. Gibeah being Saul's hometown. That's where he had his residence throughout his reign. It was later, much later, that the palace of the king was moved to Jerusalem. That was in Gibeah of Saul, and the ruins, as I mentioned once before, have been uncovered, and it appears to be not only a palace but also like a fortress, which would give some indication of Saul's lack of trust in God. It would seem to me he was scared. And he had good reason to be. And so he built his palace in such a way that it would ward off the enemies. But it was in Gibeah of Saul. And that's where it remained. And, of course, David became king in Hebron. But later, he went to Jerusalem. And there he served the remainder of his time as the king of Israel. But at this time, the Philistines are in Michmash. Saul is in Gibeah. Jonathan is somewhere away from Saul at this time, and he's out there with his armor bearer. Jonathan was kind of a leader of men at this time. He had an armor bearer, and Jonathan made a suggestion to the armor bearer. Let's go over there. Let's go where the enemy is. And let's take them on, basically, is what he was saying. Where was Saul? Where was Saul? Yeah, and what was he doing? He was under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. People were with him, about 600 men. Earlier we saw that the army was About 3,000, you remember. Now it's dwindled down to 600. People are, where are they? The majority of the people? Hiding. Okay, they're in hiding. Wherever they could find a hiding place. So he's got the nucleus of a standing army. What's wrong with that? Standing army. Remember one of the things that that Samuel said when he was telling them the nature of the king, said he will he'll take your, what was that? Yeah, okay. He'll introduce the draft. He'll have your sons as charioteers, as people run before the chariots. He'll have them as captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and we're going to have an army. Was that necessary? What had happened back when Nahash the Ammonite made that ridiculous, not a proposal, threat against those people that Saul eventually delivered from them? He sent out some, within a week, he had over, what was it, 330,000 men. He had 330,000 men. Within a week, he had them at the scene of the battle that ensued. And the Ammonites were just routed. It wasn't necessary to have a standing army. But Samuel said, that's what's going to happen when you get your king. Didn't seem to make a whole lot of difference to them. They later admitted they were wrong. But anyway, he's got his army. It's not very big now, but it's going to get bigger. Not because of his, not because he was such a great leader at this time. Things had begun to unravel already for Saul, although he had decades of time that he would reign over Israel. But it would be greatly encumbered. We might say the reign of Saul would be because of his moving away from God instead of being like he was when he began, little in his own eyes, as Samuel said later. Jonathan then told his armor bearer, let's go on over there. They were on each side of a deep, I guess wide ravine, very steep. It talks about in this version a sharp rock on each side. I gather it means a considerable drop off. The big ditch kind of went east and west. One faced north toward Michmash, the other faced south toward Gibeah. And when Jonathan suggested this, the armor bearer didn't say, crazy? They got a big army over there. Remember how many they've got? This multitudes as the sand of the sea? And here you wanting me to go with you? No, he said, let's go. He had trust in God as Jonathan did. Have you ever wondered how things would have been if Jonathan had eventually become king? Well, that's a moot question, of course, but people have said, power corrupts. Seems to have corrupted, and it doesn't necessarily follow that. I've heard people say somebody gets into public office, they just become a crook. That's not necessarily true, but so often it is. And it was true in the case of Saul. But Jonathan seems to place his trust in God. We'll see that in a little bit. His trust was not in the arm of flesh. And you have to wonder, would things have gone better than they did under Saul? Or would he have become power hungry? Would he have become smitten with himself as Saul did? Anyway, Jonathan at this point is, and all through his life, I think, was a one who trusted in God. And so he took the armor bearer. They went down into the ravine. They went up on the other side. And, okay. And where have we heard that before? Just this past week. Well, those three men. What was his name? That had the same idea. Asa. Asa had a similar idea. You remember back in the case of Gideon facing the Midianites. God says, too many men. Let's get rid of some of them. Still too many. Let's get rid of some of them. 300 men. And that's what God used. So that the glory would be His. Rather than that of the people. And rather than the size of the army and the military might and all this stuff that seems to be so important in the world today. He said that God's able to do it with few or many, just however He wants to do it. Sometimes He had large armies. Sometimes He had two people like this. Jesus didn't. Yeah. Yes, that's right. That's right, David, as he later on went out and faced the giant all by himself. Nowadays, with the weaponry we've got now, we think, well, all he'd had to do was go out there with some big gun or something like that, he'd have gone down. But he went out there with a sling, threw a stone, and then used the weapons of the day. Yes, the battle was the Lord's. It wasn't the fact that he certainly wasn't big enough to take on Goliath. And so it is with Jonathan. He said, the Lord's able to do it with just you and me. So they went, and they climbed, they began, Jonathan, I don't know how he knew, but I think he knew that the purpose for Israel was that they occupy that land. The Philistines should have been driven out centuries before, but they were there as that thorn in the flesh, a thorn in the eyes of the people of Israel, as was true with other tribes that were not completely routed. Not to say that Israel didn't receive everything that was promised to them. They received the land. Not one promise that was given to them failed to take place, but they didn't drive all the people out, and it was a constant burden on them and a temptation. And the Philistines were one of the worst. A warlike people that just loved to fight. And it showed. I had to throw that in. But anyway, they had this, Jonathan knew that God was on their side. He knew that he came up with this plan by which he would determine whether it was God's will that they attack them or not, these two people. And what was that plan that he had? What was the key that would unlock the door as far as whether to go in or stay back? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. If they say you wait and we'll come out there and meet you, then he'd say, okay, that means God doesn't want us to do it. Everything hinged on God's will in the matter. Well, it turned out that so both of them showed themselves. They went out. They exposed themselves to the Philistines. They were standing right there where they could see them. Didn't know who. I guess the Philistines didn't know who else was there, because something they said a little later on. In fact, in verse 11 says, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've hidden." He's thinking that the Philistines are thinking that. These two men are here, but Hebrews, the people of Israel, are coming out of the holes. They're coming out of hiding. They were basing it on the fact that these two men were standing there where they could see them plainly. Yeah, yes, and that kind of conjures up some thoughts about their courage and their loyalty and their faith and trust in God and things of that kind. And we'll have some opportunity to mention that. Anyway, they said, come on out and we'll show you something. We'll teach you a lesson. Come on and face us. And so they climbed up on their hands and knees, kind of a tough climb. But they got up to the top, and when they came over the edge of that sharp rock cliff there, what did they do? Did they stand around and, size up the situation? Did they see what the best strategy would be to attack these people or not attack them, as the case may be? Just went after them. They faced one. They faced another. In all, they destroyed how many Philistines? 20 in what space? About a half an acre. I don't know how much this building covers. Probably more than a half an acre, I guess. Anyway, very, very small amount of land, and these 20 men, and there are these two men out there. They were not doing it because they were such good fighters. Remember what he said? God is able to do it with many or few. And so that first slaughter which Jonathan, this verse 14, that's first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within half an acre of land. There was trembling in the camp. The trembling has shifted from the Israelites, the people of Israel, to the Philistines. They began to be afraid. They began to be concerned. The garrison, the raiders, trembled. The earth quaked. There was very great trembling. And the watchmen that were with Saul, as they were, his army was over here. They were biding their time. They weren't going into the fight. They were equivocating, I guess you might say. But they had watchmen who were kind of looking out to see what the situation was, and they saw the commotion that was going on over there. And they knew that something was going on. They knew that a battle was taking place. And so Saul said to Ahijah, I didn't mention Ahijah back here in verse 3. Ahijah was the great-grandson of Eli, the priest in the beginning of the book of 1 Samuel. There was Eli, and there was Phinehas, and then there was Ahitub, and then there was Ahijah. There are a lot of Ahijahs in the Bible. This is the one who is at this point the priest. He was this was of the family of Ithamar. You remember there were Eleazar and Ithamar, the sons of Aaron, who were priests. And there were those descendants of Eleazar. Notice later there was a man by the name of Zadok who was of his lineage. But there was the descendants of Ithamar. Prophecy had been made concerning the descendants of Eli. They would cease to be. That family would be cut off because of the wickedness of Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli. But at this particular point, that hasn't taken place. It's very shortly going to take place. But at this particular point, Ahijah is the high priest. Saul calls him over and wants him to, they've got the ark there. And the incident right here indicates some of the way that Saul thinks regarding sacrifice and obedience. He says, "Now we need to make a sacrifice here." It was a military move. It was a strategic move. It wasn't because he was all that concerned about doing the will of God and being obedient to God, but rather he was wanting to do something religious, I guess you might say, so that he could gain a military advantage. Well, after he saw that things were going pretty well over there, he told the priest, "Withdraw your hand. Step back. Don't think you're going to need this." It's like sliding off, like the story I heard many years ago about a man sliding off the roof and he prayed for help. And all of a sudden a nail caught the seat of his pants. He stopped. He said, "Never mind. I'm caught on a nail." When you pray for something and God gives it to you, then you give credit to God. You don't say, "Never mind." He said, "Withdraw your hand. I don't really need your help right now." Did I see a hand? Yeah.
It may be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Asked,
yeah.
And so all the priests
asked,
now the priest
is the Lord. Yeah, right. It's like he was when he offered the sacrifice earlier. So anyway, this is right before the things that Bill was talking about a while ago. He saw that they were being successful. Let's go on and fight. Don't have time to fool with this sacrifice. Then the Hebrews who were with the Philistines, some of them had defected to the Philistines. They saw which way the wind was blowing. They knew who was in the driver's seat, so they went over to the Philistines. And so they saw the way that the power had shifted. They left the Philistines and came over with the Israelites. The men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains, the caves, the rocks, the thickets, the holes, all those places where they'd hidden, they came out Everybody was brave then. The army of Israel is winning now, so they came out. The battle shifted to Beth Haven. The men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed them under an oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening, before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." He had placed a sanction on them about eating anything. That utter foolishness. Some famous general many years ago, I think, may have said something like, "An army travels on its stomach. You got to eat in order to be able to do anything that is very strenuous." Certainly, the marching, and all the things that a soldier has to do. Well, anyway, he had placed this restriction on them. Jonathan had been all over there doing the Lord's work, and so he didn't hear about it. And so he was beginning to get kind of hungry. He was going along with his armor bearer. He had a staff in his hand. People carried staffs as they walked, and he saw this honey that had dripped from some wild honey that had dripped on the ground. It looked pretty good. He was hungry. He put his staff down there, got some of it, tasted it, and he felt better. His eyes brightened up. Well, somebody pointed out to him this rule that Saul had placed on him. And what was Jonathan's reply regarding that rule and about his father? Yeah, well, he said, "My father has troubled the land. Look now how my countenance has brightened." He has recognized that his father wasn't what he ought to have been, and not what he thought he was originally, apparently. But anyway, he said, how much better would it have been if everybody had eaten something and then gone into the battle? More of the enemy of the Lord's people would have been eliminated if they had done that. They had driven the Philistines back, but they would have done more if they had been able to eat something. The people were just about starved to, well, maybe not to death at this point, but to the point that they were faint. They had gained the advantage over the Philistines. They had taken spoil. The Philistines had all these flocks and herds and things like that, and they just rushed upon them and slaughtered them. And I guess they cooked them, surely. But anyway, what problem did they have? Why they got in a big rush because they were just felt like they were starving. And what did they fail to do that they should have done? Drain the blood out. That's one thing as far back as I remember. My mother would say, "Make sure you drain the blood out. Get rid of all the blood." That's something that's always been true from the beginning. You don't eat blood. Same thing's true today. We see over in the book of Acts chapter 15. You don't eat blood. And it just boggles my mind that there are people today who will eat blood, blood sausage. The German guys that I used to work with down in Culbin back when I was a young fella, I think they called it something, well, their delicacies, something called Blutschwig or something like that, blood sausage. But the Bible says you don't eat blood. But anyway, these people they were eating it with the blood, and it was told Saul what they'd done. Well, Saul, you know, there were certain things he wouldn't do. As Bob mentions in his book on this subject, he said whenever God's will suited him, then he'd do God's will. When it didn't, he did what Saul wanted. Well, he didn't believe in eating the blood, and that just happened to be part of God's will. And so he told them, bring it over here. And they got rid of the blood, and the people partook of it. They offered a sacrifice. They built an altar. They plundered them from morning light. And he told them, let's go and let's plunder them let's spend all night long plundering the people and not leave any of them, not leave anybody alive. And again, the priest intervenes in this situation. It was an oh yeah moment for Saul, I guess. The priest, Ahijah, said, "Let us draw near to God here." And so Saul said, Saul asked counsel of God, and so, you know, when he was reminded of something, sometimes he would do it. And he asked counsel from God. And what happened when he asked for God? He didn't get an answer. God didn't answer. He said, there's something wrong here. There's sin in the camp, like was said back in the time of Joshua, the case of Achan. Anyway, he went through this ceremony, casting of lots, see who was guilty. Now, God had not said for them not to eat. This was something that Saul did, but for some reason or other, maybe it was just to bring Saul out in the open and get a point across to him. I don't know what it was. I've tried to figure that out. Why did God not answer it? But anyway, after the casting of lots, as the wise man said in the book of Proverbs, chapter 13, I believe it is, the lot is cast into the lap, but the decision is from the Lord. They cast lots on up until the time of the early church they cast lots and Matthias took Judas's place. From then on, the gospel was preached and went into all the world. The Spirit came upon the apostles and they went forth preaching the gospel and guided into all truth. And we don't read of casting lots anymore. But at this time, they cast lots and the lot eventually fell on Jonathan. And he said, and this shows Saul's attitude toward his son as a person. He wanted him as one to carry on his dynasty, but he didn't seem to care much for him as his son, as we would care for our son or daughter. Anyway, he said, "You're going to die, Jonathan." Jonathan, okay. But the people intervened, said, "Not going to happen." And Saul backed down. And they saved Jonathan out of the hand of Saul. Well, Saul went on. He is established his sovereignty over the land. He was becoming more and more king-like. At first, he was this farmer boy that didn't really quite know what he was doing in that particular office, but he had been thrust into it, and he did a good job to begin with. And then he got thinking like a king, and he established his sovereignty, began to go here and there, fighting against the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites. Anybody that he could find to pick a fight with, he was the big man around there at that time. Gathered an army, fought against the Amalekites. And it talks about his army. It talks about his family. Tells all the members of his family. Some of them will figure into things later on. Abner was the head of his army. He had a standing army, you remember. Had to have a head over it. Abner was a good man. David said he was a good man. David said he was better than the commander of David's army. Said that Joab had killed a man who was better than him later on. But he had his standing army, and he fought against people. There was fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul. And of course, eventually the Philistines began because of the continuing weakening of Saul and his continuing leaving God, Philistines became stronger and stronger. When we get to the last chapter in the book of 1 Samuel, the Philistines destroy the family, or Saul and his sons anyway. The sons apparently were not in the same of the same attitude as Saul, but they were the victims of his folly. But anyway, he was establishing himself. He established his sovereignty, and he was building his army. And the last verse of chapter 14, when Saul saw any strong man, any valiant man, he took him for himself. That's significant, I think. He took him for himself. He was always thinking about himself, building up his army, getting him good men. He wanted not just a few good men. He wanted a lot of them. And he built up this great army. In fact, as we come to chapter 15, we're going to have to hurry along in order to get this in. But we did, those of us who were here this past week, had a good lesson on 1 Samuel 15. And when Brother Hall was talking about it, I thought,
We're going to be studying that Sunday, and it's going to sound a little redundant, isn't it?
Well, as I studied over it, I thought that's a pretty good study for us to have today. You know the story. It ranks along with several other stories, like Naaman the leper, that have been used over and over and over to show the necessity of obedience. Back in the book of Exodus, chapter 15, the Amalekites had withstood the Israelites as they were coming out of Egypt. In chapter 25 of Deuteronomy, they were told that after you've gotten settled in the land, you're to destroy the Amalekites. Well, here it is, more than four centuries later, and God says through Samuel to Saul, time to go and take care of that detail. Go and fight against the Amalekites. Destroy all of them. Everything, even down to the, and we don't even like to think about it, but he said even down to the small baby. And everything that they own, their flocks, their herds, whatever. And so he amassed, by this time, that 600 men because, I guess, of his successes and his aggressiveness. In various ways, he had an army of 210,000 men. They went to the a city of Amalekites. They lay in wait. The Kenites, who were kind of over in this area, where is it? Over in this area, the Amalekites here. They told the Kenites to get out of there. Don't get caught in the crossfire. You don't want you to be hurt. They were friendly with the. They had been friends of the Israelites over the years. There was some relationship, kinship with them. Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, had helped them back during the time of Deborah and Barak. Anyway, told them to get out, and so he began to carry out the command. But he stopped short. He saved Agag. He saved the people wanted to, and I don't know whether it was all together the people. I think Saul had cast longing eyes on those good-looking sheep, oxen, and all those things out there. And so they saved them. They brought them back. Well, God told Samuel before Saul got back that what had happened, said, I'm sorry that I made him king. But Saul didn't come right directly back. He stopped off in Carmel to make him a monument to himself for his success and his achievement. He was always concerned about himself, wasn't he? Took these valiant men to himself. He built a monument to himself. Well, anyway, Samuel confronted him. Oh, he said, I've performed the Lord's command. He said, what about the lowing of the ox and the blading of the sheep? And then he began making his excuses. Yeah, he said, well, what about this over here? Well, they hadn't thought of that, I guess. Well, then he began to make excuse. It was the people. We want to make sacrifice to the Lord your God. More than once he says, the Lord your God. This is your God that I'm wanting to offer these things for. Anyway, Samuel said to him, has God his great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Sure, he wants sacrifice. That's not the important thing. You can't do whatever you want to do. You can't do works of iniquity. In fact, as he uses the word iniquity and idolatry in verse 23, rebellion is the sin of witchcraft. Stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. And you can't offer enough sacrifices to where you can just do whatever you want to the rest of the time. First of all, you obey. Then you offer the sacrifice. Anyway, he told Samuel, or told Saul, that of God's displeasure with this situation. He wanted to get forgiveness, but it was kind of a flippant way that he went about it. And so, anyway, he said, another time, just like when he offered the sacrifice that he wasn't supposed to, this is the end of your kingdom. I wish we'd had a little more time to spend on that, but I think we're familiar with that story, perhaps more than most of them. We'll take the next lesson.